It's Jeff Levering for Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin. Check out that effortless horizontal window slide and the best lifetime warranties in the industry. Order by April 30th and get 0% for 48 months at PellaWI.com.
Certain restrictions apply.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank. Get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. Eric Bilstead. Jerry Springer, dead at the age of 79.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch the old Jerry Springer show?
Of course I did.
Okay. I understand that the time goes by. It is impossible to understate how significant a factor he was. His show ran for 27 years, and it started in the early 1990s, and his last show was in 2018. But there was a period of time, particularly in the mid-1990s, when that was the top-rated show on daytime television. Right, exactly. And like that was when Oprah Winfrey had her show and stuff. And in many markets, for a period of time, Jerry Springer beat Oprah Winfrey in the ratings. And it was just, for people who've never seen it before, I mean, it was one of those things where if you get invited to go on the Jerry Springer show, it's probably one where you say no, because that's one where you find out you're sitting there and you find out your wife of 10 years is really your long lost sister. You know, it's that kind of stuff. And your family tree is a wreath. You know, I mean, that's the type. And then I was just looking at the titles of some of the last episodes. Stripper sex turned me straight. Hooking up with my therapist. Stop pimping my twin sister, you know, but that's what it was. And for people who hadn't seen it, there would be, you'd have these things. And a lot of times it was a surprise, you know, that would be again, oh, it turns out that, you know, that the husband and wife couple are on there. Oh, no, that's actually, you know, I put your wife up for adoption. You know, the mom comes up there and says that stuff.
There's always a fight or two.
Oh, lots of fight. Oh, right. Yeah. You'd have the big security guards that would come, and then they'd have to all bleep out the stuff, you know, as the people were going after each other. And, you know, and actually, what I liked about Jerry Springer, didn't particularly like the show that much, but he understood what he was. I mean, he didn't take it too seriously and stuff. And for everybody that just thought this is the end of civilization, he said, look, you know, television doesn't create values. It just pictures what's out there, you know?
He said it's entertainment.
Yeah, right. Well, exactly. And I think he kind of got that. And you can, you know, you can argue about whether it, you know, dumbed down our social values and stuff. And you think the answer is probably yes. But at the same time, people embraced it. You know, who do you end up blaming with that?
Enjoy being entertained, even if it's about whether or not someone's the father or whatever child.
Right. And then the fights and stuff. I was a teenage call girl or whatever that. And, you know, it was just. But that was the style of television that was incredibly popular, and there were a number of other like shock sort of TV shows that were out there. But he was, I think, the pioneer in that.
If you would have asked me before today, like yesterday, hey, how late do you think that show went? You know, how many years ago has it been going? I was shocked to hear that he still had a show in 2018. I didn't realize it had lasted that long.
Yeah, no, and the popularity had gone down.
Oh,
it was syndicated, so it wasn't carried as much. Well. At some point in time, you start repeating yourself. You know, I mean, it's kind of like, okay, I've seen that show, and it's like, okay, you know, your best friend turns out to have a crush on you. It was those type of things that were out there, but it was just what was always amazing to me is that people would go on the show. I mean, that's the
right.
It really shows the thirst that people have to put themselves on television, that the idea is, okay, I know what this is going to be. I might not know exactly what's going to happen, but I know what this is, and yet I'm going to leave the trailer park. I'm going to go down to the TV station. I'm going to on TV. I mean, how do you think this is going to turn out?
It shouldn't be any surprises. You're right.
No, but that was it. There's a song called, it's a Jimmy Buffett song when he was going through his country phase years ago. It's called Simply Complicated. And he's talking about how life can get kind of like messy and stuff. And, you know, when you're on the Jerry Springer show, that's the first tip that maybe you need to kind of straighten stuff out with that. So Jerry Springer, dead at the age of 79. And you're right. I thought the show was gone for a lot longer than that. And it would never occur to me that that style of entertainment could last for 30 years.
Right. 27. This is amazing.
Yeah, it is. And before that, I mean, he was a newscaster. And, of course, mayor. He was the mayor of Cincinnati. And he was, there was a period of time where he ended up not running. But he was a serious candidate for governor. I thought there was a serious move to make him governor of Ohio.
Look what we would have missed.
Look what we would have missed. I mean, it's kind of like Donald Trump becoming president. You know, who would have thought that the guy on The Apprentice, you know, was going to be the president of the United States? And there you go. So anyway, Jerry Springer, dead at the age of 79. If you were of a certain age, you can remember how big that show was. Hey, if you follow me on Twitter, it's at Jeff Wagner 620. Number of different postings since we spoke last, including one, and it's Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up. I was watching, or at least some of the still pictures before the press conference with Aaron Rodgers in New York yesterday, and I guess all it took was a trade to the top media market in the country to inspire Aaron Rodgers to trim his beard and lose that John Wick look, you know, the long, greasy hair and stuff like that. If you look at him showing up for this press conference yesterday, I mean, he looks like he stepped out of GQ. And I mean, I understand at the end of last year, like I was saying, he cut his hair a little bit, but he cut his hair in a weird fashion. It was kind of like George McFly, the father from Back to the Future. You know, he's like shaved on one side and really weird. He looks like the kind of guy who would be auditioning for a whole bunch of commercial endorsements. And all it took was maybe just getting traded to the top media market in the country to do that. And I do wish him well. And I think hope the Packers over the course of the next couple of days can, you know, use the draft picks or moving up in the draft to better their team as well. So I actually think the Packers got a really good deal on that, given the fact that they didn't want to pay him. They didn't want Aaron Rodgers anymore. So I think that's good. We are not going to be talking about the Milwaukee Bucks today. Tough game yesterday. Again, I sent out a tweet about this, and this is all I have to say about the Bucks. It was a tough end to the season. Undoubtedly, there's going to be a lot of off-season soul-searching, you know, what went wrong, etc. That said, here's my message. It's just a game. Our lives continue. Your spouse probably still loves you, and I guarantee that your dog still loves you. So at the end of the day, you know, we get wrapped up in sports, and we're fans and things like that, and it was a disappointing end. But at the end of the day, you know, the sun came up this morning. You probably went to work like you usually did. The coffee tastes just as good as it always does. And like I say, your dog still loves you. So that's all I have to say about the Bucks. And how about those Brewers? Big win yesterday. When we come back, potholes. Stick around.
About yourself that you hadn't thought to know. When your grandma calls and books you on the Jerry Springer Show, and you find out you and your wife for 10 years just might be related. Brother, life's not over, it's just simply complicated.
It's just simply complicated. Yep, that's Jimmy Buffett. You know you've made it when you're memorialized in a Jimmy Buffett song, and, you know, he's got a great point about being on the Jerry Springer Show. If you're just tuning in, Jerry Springer passing away at the age of 79 after a brief battle with pancreatic cancer. You can argue that he was responsible for completely dumbing down the culture. He just said, hey, look, I'm just kind of the ringmaster on the end of civilization, and if people want to watch it, they want to watch it. And not my style. It's not the style of talk show that I do, but there's unquestionably he found a niche and was incredibly, incredibly successful. All right. It is no secret, if you drive around southeastern Wisconsin, that you risk your car every time. And I'm not talking today about running red lights or driving 90 miles an hour or things like that. I'm talking about something more common, those giant holes in the street, the potholes that are out there. And if you think the potholes are worse this year than in past years, you would be right. Now, why do we get potholes? Well, you get potholes because the climate around here is extremely tough on the roads. You have a freeze and then a thaw cycle where you have snow or whatever that melts, and it gets into cracks in the concrete, and then it freezes again, and it expands, and it causes the roads to deteriorate. So you have pothole problems in, for example, Milwaukee, that you don't have if you're driving around Naples, Florida, because you don't have that freeze-thaw situation. The city of Milwaukee is apparently becoming overwhelmed with requests to fix potholes. The requests, over 3,000 in March, 2,500 in April, compared to fewer than 1,500 and 2,000 in the same months last year, are apparently outstripping the ability of the DPW to address them. And so there was a hearing yesterday where a number of members of the Common Council expressed their frustrations over this because they're hearing from their constituents. I mean, there's some things that people are willing, they might have opinions on it one way or the other, but it doesn't necessarily motivate them to call the alderman. And the last thing aldermen want, let's be honest, is to have their phones ringing with people complaining about something. That's just not what they want. And that has been happening all spring with complaints about the potholes. And why is it that people call to complain about the potholes? Well, it's because it affects everybody. You know, you're driving down the street and all of a sudden you hit one of these craters and boom, your tire blows out or your alignment gets thrown off. Or, you know, you destroyed the rims of your car. They're dangerous. It's an eyesore, but it's also a very, very costly thing if you have to go in and you have to, you know, have it taken care of. Now, the city, as a matter of policy, will not compensate people for repairs to the cars. There's this process where you can appeal and you can say, hey, I think that there's this giant pothole and it cost me like $700 because of damage to my car and I want you to pay. And it goes to the Common Council. And I'm not sure the Common Council has ever signed off on paying somebody for that. So, okay, we've got a problem and I understand that it's the weather. But at the same time, the question becomes, what do you do about it? And in the story in the local newspaper, one of the aldermen at this hearing yesterday, and everybody else is saying, we've got to do better. We've got to do better. We've got to do better. One of the aldermen, Jonathan Brostoff, contended that the reason for the pothole problem was the state-imposed limits on the city's ability to increase revenue and the lack of shared revenue returning to the state. So he says, that's put us in a position that makes it difficult to get the work done. If the resources aren't there and the staffing levels aren't there, nothing can get done. And that's the starting point for the conversation, because I don't buy that for a minute. You know, whether it's the potholes, at least in my opinion, are worse in Milwaukee than they are in surrounding communities. And I understand that there's all these explanations. We've got the freeze-thaw rate. We need there's not enough hot mix asphalt that's out there, and that fills these things in better, et cetera. But while you've got potholes all over, you know, it doesn't seem to me to be as bad in West Allis or in Glendale or in Mequon or in Brookfield. This seems to be a particularly bad problem in Milwaukee. And the idea that we don't have enough money to fix this, I think, is ridiculous. It's a question of the priorities that you want to have. And the whole idea is if you make everybody understand that this is, in fact, a big deal, it then, in fact, becomes a priority. And as far as pleading poverty, give me a break. Now, look, I understand there's this shared revenue issue that's out there, but we're talking about fixing potholes. And this is the same city that can take $15 million and use it to spend to tear down the buildings at Northridge instead of simply allowing a private company to take over and do the same thing. This is the same city that wants to spend 15 point whatever million dollars turning a prime piece of commercial real estate into a park on Wisconsin Avenue, primarily to reserve the space so that if and when they ever get money to build a streetcar, it'll be a streetcar location. But this idea is that we don't have enough money to fix the potholes? Give me a break. It's the same argument that you heard with streetlights. You know, 2 years ago, They put in a streetlight fee that people have to pay. The average city resident has to pay $40 a year. And as near as I can tell, almost none of the $20 million that they've raised from the streetlight fees has gone to fix the streetlights. Instead, it just goes into the general revenue thing. So I don't think this is a question of lack of resources. It's a question of lack of priorities. Meanwhile, people have to deal with the potholes. Our number, 855-616-1620, that is the old National Bank talk and text line. How bad are potholes this year? And do you buy the idea that, well, we just don't have enough money to fix them? You are too smart for me. People are catching on to this. Well, we can't fix the potholes because we don't have enough money. One of our texters says, I guess for every situation and problem the city of Milwaukee has, there's only one answer. Not enough money from the state. Absolutely. That's the default position. We just don't have enough money to fix the potholes. Nuts to that. It is a question of priorities. And clearly this has not been a priority. Jeff, I own a small trucking company. Potholes have cost me over $4,000 in repairs so far this year. My trucks need to be roadworthy or I get fined, but the roads aren't truck-worthy. Amen. Three or four people also make this point. Jeff, I'm a little unclear. What's this wheel tax for? Now, think about that. If you choose to keep your car in Milwaukee County, you pay an extra tax, right? If you're, I think the straight registration is $85 if you live outside of Milwaukee County. It's more if you live in Milwaukee County. And then if you live in the city of Milwaukee, you pay an extra, what is it, $25 or $30, whatever it is, to keep your car, the wheel tax. Well, what's the wheel tax for? One of our texters says, I thought it was to repair the roads. Well, I did too. So you're getting charged extra for the privilege of keeping your car in the city of Milwaukee, and nothing is happening. And whether this is the streetlights not getting repaired or the potholes not being fixed. And look, and I understand. I get the idea that you've got this freeze-thaw cycle. I understand the hot asphalt thing. I get all those arguments. But it's worse in Milwaukee than it is in any of the surrounding communities, I would argue. You have people that are calling. They're complaining over and over and over again. Their aldermen are sick of getting these calls. And there's nothing they can do because they are being held hostage by a Department of Public Works who has its priorities all out of whack. And to plead poverty is absolutely ridiculous. Get a couple people who are doing other things, put them on the pothole trucks, and get the things filled. People should not have to experience thousands of dollars of damage to their car because they hit these craters that occur. And it's not like potholes are unforeseeable. It happens every year. This year's a little bit worse. But if you're upset about it, you have every right to do so. Now the question is, what are the politicians going to do about it? And while I'm at it, remember a few years ago, you had all the commercials, the Scott Holes commercial when Evers was running against Scott Walker back in 2018. Remember, there was all these ads that were out there. Oh, you've got all these potholes that are all over. Vote for Tony Evers. You know, he's going to take care of all the problems. Well, okay, here we are. You know, it's now 2023, and you've got potholes that are worse than ever. I mean, if it's not Scott Holes anymore, what are they, Cavalier craters? I don't know. Fill in the blank. But it's this mismanagement of money. You know, Eric was talking about how they're going to announce this plan that they're going to get more shared revenue for the city. I am so glad that they're going to do that. You know why? Because I am sick to death of hearing this excuse. Well, you know, the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County is incredibly mismanaged. They spend money in a fashion that would embarrass drunken sailors. The priorities are completely out of whack. And every time somebody tries to point that out, the argument is, we don't get enough money back. We don't get enough money back. Give us more money. Okay, the problem isn't money, in my opinion. The problem is that you have incredible mismanagement. You have priorities out of whack. We've got millions and millions of dollars to tear down Northridge when a private company would do it for free. But no, 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 we don't want to have a storage facility up there. We want to I don't know, we want to save the space to try to recreate Northridge in 1985. Ain't going to happen. So we're going to spend $15 million. The list goes on and on. We're going to spend over $1 million a year to subsidize the trolley that nobody ends up riding. It goes on and on. But whenever you try to say, okay, this is a stupid use of money. Oh, no. We can't keep the cops on the streets because we don't get enough shared revenue back. So that's, I'm glad. Give more shared revenue back to the city of Milwaukee, because I'm sick of hearing this excuse. And my guess is, even if you adjust the sales tax and even if you adjust shared revenue, you're still going to have this out of whack priority system where we take millions of dollars and put it into an Office of Violence Prevention, a name that sounds really good, but all we're doing is paying to send bureaucrats to conferences and things of the like. Give the city more money. It's probably not going to make a difference because, like I say, the priorities are out of whack. But at least it will stop people from complaining and maybe just hold people more accountable for the failures that are going on. Yeah, Scott holes no more. Now they're Cavalier craters. What are people going to do? When we come back, it's called equitable grading. We'll discuss. That's it. Yeah, that's a okay. If they're not, they can't be Scott holes anymore, right? And I'm surprised they're still there because remember Tony Ever said that he's fixed the damn roads. Remember? So what do we call them if they can't be Scott holes? Cavalier chasms, Cavalier craters, Cavalier crevices. I'm just kind of wondering. There's all sorts of things that could be out there. Tony troughs, you know, whatever, you just kind of figure this out. But this was supposed to be one of the reasons to elect Tony Evers in 2018, because you had to fix the roads. What has happened with that? All right, let us switch gears. It's called equitable grading. Now, historically, when you've been in, and maybe this goes back, I'm sure, when you were in school, what happened is your grade was based on a number of factors, right? It would be based on how well you did on the tests. You know, they'd have periodic quizzes and then you'd have the exams. It would be based on how well you did in classroom participation. It would be based on some cases like extra credit stuff that you had the opportunity to do. And it would be based in part on attendance. You know, you got to show up. If you don't show up, you're going to get, you know, you're going to get downgraded. Well, the new pitch in schools right now is to move away from having people do homework, having people follow and meet deadlines, in favor of something called equitable grading. So the way it typically works, and it varies from school to school, but it starts out with extra credit is banned. No extra points for, you know, doing extra behavior. No grading for behavior, which includes habits such as attendance. So if you don't show up, you're not going to be penalized. The scale starts typically at 50%, which means that a student's grade can never really sink low enough because of missed assignments and failing to do stuff that they end up failing. So you start at 50%, not zero. The grading, the equitable grading, doesn't reflect on attendance again. And the idea is you don't really have to show up, because it punishes kids for working after school or things like that. So, you know, why do we need to show up to do stuff? And then when it comes to grading, exams, well, the whole idea behind equitable grading is it wants to make sure that at the end of the course, you know the material. So who cares if you, I don't know, flunk a whole bunch of exams before that point? You know, let's say you've got like tests every 2 weeks to measure how the material. Well, so you fail a test after the first 2 weeks. As long as you know that material at the end of the year, does it matter if you got an F in those first 2 weeks? And so that's the whole idea, that essentially the ongoing exams don't matter. Showing up doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is, Do you, you know, can you pass the exam at the end? And if you can pass the exam at the end, well, fine. That's all we should care about. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. Doing this pretty much guarantees that it's almost impossible to fail a class. But the whole idea is behind this equitable grading is we don't want to require attendance. We don't want to require class participation. It doesn't matter if you're there or not. We don't want to reward extra credit. And if you don't do assignments, no big deal. Do it later. So if the assignment is due on Friday and you don't turn it in, you're not going to be penalized. Turn it in 3 weeks from when it's due, and they'll still look at it. And as long as it's a passing assignment, you'll get a passing grade for that. Our number, 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. Now, like I say, equitable grading works out. It's applied differently in different schools. But that's essentially the essence of it. We don't want people to fail. We don't want to put deadlines on people. We don't want to punish people for missing or failing exams along the way. And by the way, if you fail a test in the first couple weeks, you fail it on one segment, and you want to retake that test a month later, we'll let you retake that test. And if you pass it then, well, what do we care about if you failed it the first time? 855-616-1620. Is this a good way to run a railroad, or in this case, a school system? Yeah, they call it equitable grading. And the idea is if you fail a test, okay, you fail a test, no big deal, no problem. You can retake it whenever you want during the course of the semester. And if you can show by the end of the semester that you can pass the test, well, then you should get a passing grade. Why do we worry about segments and stuff like that? And why do we put arbitrary deadlines on learning for kids? And why do we put pressure on kids to show up in class and things like that? As long as they're able to, I don't know, download what they need to do from YouTube and figure this out, you know, they should be able to get passing grades. How did we go so far through the looking glass here? Let's start with Paul from Northern Illinois. Hi, Paul. You're on WTMJ.
Yeah, hi, Jeff. I just can't believe where even the education system is now giving out participation trophies. I mean, Jeff, in the future, would you really want your cardiologist or neurosurgeon to have graduated or passed through this? No, the healthcare professionals, doctors, dentists, nurses, they're there because they're smart. They applied themselves. They had the passions. They had the drives. But they had the hard work to make it for healthcare. And I just can't believe that's what they really want your future doctors. Granted, their diplomas do not say their GPAs, but they're there because they made it and they made a difference.
Well, absolutely. Thanks. But it's also teaching people what they need to do. And thanks a lot for the call, Paul. You know, moving forward for in real life. I mean, in real life, you got to show up. That is the bottom line. I always tell people that, at least in my opinion, you know, showing up is 75 to 80% of the job. I mean, because if you don't show up, there's no way that you're going to be able to succeed. So the idea, I don't feel like coming into work today. My throat's a little bit sore, or you know, I was kind of out late last night, or boy, there's an English Premier League soccer game that I'd really like to watch at 1 o'clock, and I'm not going to be able to do that if I have to go into that job. So you know, what's the big deal? Well, that's, I think, the lesson that you're starting to teach people. Jane in Milwaukee. Jane, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi. What do you think?
Hi. I agree 100% with what you were saying. And I had an analogy, but I don't want to put anyone in a box out there. But you think about deadbeat parents.
Mm-hmm.
You just show up when you need to. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
And what kind of people are we building when we just tell them just show up when you're needed? You know
right.
what I mean? We don't need you to participate.
Right.
Just show up when we need you.
Right. And there's no consequences. Right. And don't Don't study. Don't worry. You don't have to study for that algebra test that's coming up next Friday, because if you blow it off or you fail it, no problem. You know, we'll give you another three or four chances later on. Now, the problem with that, of course, Jane, is that, you know, in so many courses, math being one of them, you need to have a framework. If you don't understand the basic math and you flunk the first thing, it's tough to understand how 3 or 4 months later you're going to be able to go back and pass it. Plus, you're going to be further lost. But we don't want to have any consequences. We don't want people to feel too much pressure from having to study and show up. Makes no sense to me.
No, thanks.
It is. And you just wonder how, you know, that's ultimately going to play out. Let's talk to Lucy on the West Side. Lucy, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hi. I want to say at the outset, I basically agree with you. So I'm not saying I disagree. But when I was in law school, and I think I was there about 10 years before you were, and I was at UW, we had something of that system. It was terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that counted was the end of term exam.
Right.
You didn't get extra credit for participation. They'd yell at you if you didn't attend, but they wouldn't. There were no consequences. Everything rode on that final exam. I have never been as scared or worked as hard in my life. There was no 6-week test to see how I was doing and say, "Oh, okay, I'm doing pretty well. I can lay back for a week now."
Right.
So it worked for me, but for a lot of people, what I saw happen is that they went through the semester thinking they were doing fine. They talked in class,
yep,
and then they flunked the exam. And you need, especially for younger kids, and this is why I agree with you, you need that measure of how you're doing so a good teacher can intervene and say, you're a wonderful student, Chucky, but you're just,
right,
you need some help here. You're not getting this.
Well, yeah, and
particularly
yeah.
If they...
Yeah, Lucy, yeah. By the way, I agree, because when I was in law school, it was pretty much the same thing. Your grade, there was some like fudge factor on participation and stuff, but your grade largely depended on your exam. But to what you were just saying, I think there's a difference between law school, where you have people who've gone through, you know, primary and secondary education, they've got their college degrees, and now you're trying for a professional thing. I think there's difference than a fourth grader, for example, where you're trying to, you know, make sure that they have basics and develop good study habits. And what might work for law school students, I don't think is a good idea for 10-year-olds.
I agree with you, and I don't think it was that good for the law students. A lot of people flunked out that wouldn't have if they had known that they were floundering.
Yeah.
So,
no, I think you're right.
Okay,
no, that's
a really bad idea for kids.
Yeah, no, we agree completely. And I can say you law school was different. I don't know that they still do that and all rides on the final exams. And you're exactly right. In my law school class, first semester, we used to call them gunners, and there were always these, it was a handful of people that liked to hear themselves talk and were volunteering and were, you know, talking in class all the time and envisioned themselves by and large as, okay, we're going to be in the top X percent of the class and stuff. And then there were the rest of us that we participated when we were called on and all. And it was interesting that after first semester grades came out, which were largely based on the result of the test, you never heard from a lot of those gunners again. Matter of fact, a couple of them ended up disappearing, exactly like you said. They flunked out because they didn't realize that even though they spoke in class, they did not have a grasp of the work. And maybe if periodically, you know, they'd been given tests and they'd been required to, I don't know, answer, you know, a few questions or do whatever, not just in the in class participation, but, you know, in a written sort of fashion that counted a little bit, you know, maybe it wouldn't have been all that dependent. But even if that system worked for law students, I don't think anybody can argue it's going to work for third and fourth graders. Education is more than just a participation sort of thing. You want to make sure people understand, and I get it, you want to make sure they understand the material, but how in reality does that all play out? You flunk a test 3 weeks in, and then, you know, then you've moved on. You're teaching new sort of things. You're going to go back 6 weeks later or 8 weeks later, and you're going to retake that test, and suddenly you're going to have figured out, you know, what was going on in that first 3 weeks. Well, no, you're going to get farther and farther behind. It's a fundamentally bad idea, You want to require people to show up. You want to require people to participate. You want to have those periodic tests. And, yeah, the exams have got to count for something. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But this idea that being there doesn't matter, I just don't know why we do this.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. Just as a follow-up to one of the things that Eric was talking about in his newscast, if you follow me on Twitter, just send out a new tweet. You can follow me. It's at Jeff Wagner 620. So for years, I have listened to the local politicians plead poverty. We can't do this. We can't do that. We can't do the other thing because we just don't have enough money from the state. It's those evil politicians in Madison that aren't giving us enough money. So don't expect us to be accountable for all the stupid decisions that we make with regard to money. It's all Madison. We don't have enough money. Don't have enough money. Don't have enough money. All right. So there's going to be, apparently there's been a breakthrough. There is a plan that's going to be rolled out that, assuming the state Senate agrees with it and assuming the governor goes along, it will increase shared revenue, the amount of money that goes back to different communities across the state, and the city will be and the county will be allowed to have a referendum to allow voters to decide if they want to increase the sales tax on themselves. So that's it. But it's been this pleading poverty for years and years. Don't hold us accountable. Don't make us have to justify the decisions we've made. We just don't get enough money. So here is now where the rubber meets the road. Okay, once the state sends more money back to Milwaukee, what are the odds that it's going to stop local politicians from continuing to blame the state for their own failure to fix potholes, repair streetlights, apprehend criminals, et cetera, et cetera? And my comment was, I'm not holding my breath. Once this goes through, they're still going to have the problems. You're still going to have the streetlights that are out. You're still going to have the criminals that aren't apprehended. You're still going to have the giant potholes. And do you think any local politicians are going to accept responsibility? Nope. It's going to be some other scapegoat, or maybe it's going to be it's not enough. It's never enough. But, okay, one of the reasons I'm really on board with sending more money back to localities is I'm tired of listening to this explanation, there's not enough money, there's not enough money, there's not enough money, when in many cases there's enough money. It's just that the way the money has been allocated is just all screwed up. But all right, let's get more money back and then let's see what the local politicians do with it. My guess is they're going to find another scapegoat to blame for why they can't do their job. But we'll give everybody the benefit of the doubt. All right. Hard truth. Let's talk about politics for a minute. And it is just a hard truth. Let me start out with this basic premise. For everybody out there who is a fan of Donald Trump, and it's one of these things where among Republican primary voters, his support is inches wide but miles deep. There are 20-30% of the Republican primary voters who are just devoted to Donald Trump. And that's it. And they're going to vote for Trump, and they're going to just go to the mattresses for Trump. Trump, his hope to get the nomination is that there's a wide field of other Republican candidates. And so if he's able to pick up 25-30% of the vote against 5 or 6 other candidates, that will carry him. And I don't know that that's going to be the case. I still think Trump ultimately isn't going to run. I know that people don't buy that. I think that a combination of stuff is going to happen that's going to end up forcing him out of the race. But regardless, even if Trump were somehow to get the Republican nomination, and I don't think he will, the hard truth is he can't win. And yes, I understand. I didn't think he was going to win in 2016, but 2016 was a much different election. He was the unknown outside candidate who was going to drain the swamp running against an extremely unpopular Hillary Clinton. It's a much different environment in 2023 and 2024. And the honest truth is he cannot win. His numbers are terrible. No Democrats are going to vote for him. Independents suburban women, the independent women that you need to win elections, by and large rejected him in 2020, and he's done nothing to bring them back in 2022 or 2023 or 2024. If Republicans nominate Donald Trump, there will be, in my opinion, an epic loss. Plus, what's going on with Trump since he left office, regardless of what you think of the job he did as president, he embarrassed himself by refusing to accept the results of an election that he lost by 7 million votes. And his behavior in calling the election fixed and rigged and things like that led to the Republicans losing control of the U.S. Senate with those Georgia runoff seats. It led directly or indirectly to all the stuff that happened on January 6th, for which he still may very well get indicted for. He's been indicted in New York in connection with this hush money scheme. I happen to think that that's kind of a BS case, but still, you know, you're defending yourself against that. I've been reading the reports of this civil trial that's going on in New York, the woman who alleges that he sexually assaulted her. Now, this supposedly happened in the 1990s. And she's vague on the dates and things like that. And I take no position on whether or not he's ultimately going to be held liable for this. But you read, you know, what the allegations are. And, you know, back then, you know, she was like an advice columnist for Elle magazine. And, you know, this is back in his real estate days. And she says what happens is they bumped into each other in Bergdorf's and he started hitting on her. And he said, hey, you know, I want some advice. I want you to kind of help me. I'm picking out, you know, stuff for, you know, whoever. And she was flattered by this. And, you know, her story is that they, you know, go back to the lingerie section and he motions her over to a dressing room and she goes in and he sexually assaults her. There's all sorts of accounts and she's very graphic about it. I don't know if it happened like she alleges it happened or not, but you know, I think it's pretty clear that something happened there. And I take no position on whether he should be held liable for this or anything like that. And it always does trouble me when you have these allegations that surface from decades ago. But my sense is something probably happened between the two of them, whether it rose to the level of sexual assault or whatever. I don't know. But you can kind of it's not too far of a stretch for me to see him doing something like this. But you have all these different allegations that are out there. And these allegations, again, make it more and more difficult to see how independent voters, women voters, could ever consider voting for him again. All right, our number is 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. As this, and the Trump campaign is running, we have CNN on one of our TV screens here, and they're running ads against, you know, about Ron DeSantis, and, you know, it's the typical Trump stuff. Trump's going to protect Medicare. Trump's going to protect Social Security. Florida is a disaster. You know, Ron DeSantis is going to, again, because Ron DeSantis realizes that Social Security and Medicare are going to go broke at some point in time and we have to do something. He's going to stand up for that. Trump will be looking out for this. The headline in the Washington Post says, Trump has an electability problem. The GOP doesn't seem to know or care. Republicans have created a permission structure for not only doubting Trump's electoral problems, but disregarding them. Here's the reality of this. In what world does anybody think that Donald Trump could win? And I guess that's, at the end of the day, I always say this, politics is the art of the possible. I think Joe Biden, and at least not necessarily Biden, but the people that are telling Biden what to do, I mean, this country has taken a hard left turn. It's moving towards socialism, whether it's let's redistribute wealth by forgiving everybody's student loans. Let's impose rules that say that people essentially can't buy cars powered by internal combustion engines, you know, within the next 4 or 5 years. And it goes on and on and on. I'm concerned about these issues for the country and where we're going. And I am concerned that this fascination that the other side, the Republican voters, might have that, oh, well, Donald Trump, you know, we love Donald Trump. Under what scenario can he possibly win? Period. And I, he might be the only Republican candidate that loses to Joe Biden. But I do not see how Trump gets more votes than he got last time. And he's probably going to get a lot less given all the you-know-what that's happened since then. Do Republican voters have an electoral death wish? 855-616-1620. We discuss. I was having dinner recently with a couple dear friends who are big Republican supporters and have done that for many, many years. And part of the way they do it is they do it with their checkbooks. And we were having this conversation, and both of the couple I was talking to, they were fans of Donald Trump. And matter of fact, they would make the argument that, well, we thought he was a pretty good president, but were disgusted by his behavior after losing and have kind of come to the conclusion that I think a lot of people have, that he will never, ever win in 2024. And for Republicans to nominate him would be a death wish. And yet there's about electoral death wish. And yet there's about 30% of the Republican primary voters who are just, they're just so enamored, we're going to vote for Donald Trump. And the scary thing is, if he's still in the race by the time the primaries kick off, that 30% may be enough to carry him to the nomination. But it almost guarantees that whether it's Joe Biden or somebody else, he's going to lose the general election. And what is it about that people don't see? 855-616-1620. Tom in Bayside. Tom, you're on WTMJ.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for taking my call. I'm absolutely scared to death. I've been a lifelong Republican, and if they're stupid enough to nominate him, we lose. If they nominate someone else, you don't think he's not going to run as a third party? Then he divides the party, and we lose. He's got to go away.
And do you see any scenario in which that happens?
You know, if he really loved our country, he would step aside, because we have to change the administration. We can't have an 86-year-old president who's just not all there.
Yeah.
So I don't think his ego.
Yep. I'm sorry, Tom. Your cell phone was cutting out there. I mean, here is the. I mean, the scenario where Trump goes away is that either the legal problems start to mount. I mean, you know, and again, I'm on record as saying I don't think much of these charges that the New York District Attorney brought, but I think that might be the first of a series of dominoes. Maybe, you know, election interference in Georgia, maybe involvement from the special prosecutor with January 6th. But I mean, I think what potentially happens is that legal troubles start to mount and you find yourself indicted in a variety of situations. You might kind of come to the conclusion that, okay, maybe trying to run a presidential campaign against this backdrop, even if, you know, 20-25% of the Republican electorate just, you know, still wants you to do it, that might especially impact the fundraising and things like that. That might happen. Also, if he becomes convinced that he's not going to be able to win, you know, you start looking at the internal poll numbers and things like that, rather than put yourself through this and publicly get beaten again, maybe you just kind of step back, and again you blame the media, you blame the corrupt prosecutors, I put that in air quotes or whatever, but you blame that. So that's why I keep thinking that there's a lot of different shoes to drop, and maybe by the time the primary season kicks off, you know, 8 months from now, maybe it's very, very different. He's already said he's not going to participate in debates. You know, the Republican Party is going to have a series of debates. He said he's not going to participate in any of those because I guess he thinks he should be entitled to the nomination. 855-616-1620. As far as the third party stuff goes, maybe that's a tough road to go. Because, again, you've got to get on the ballot and things like that, and it's much tougher to raise money in that particular fashion. But I guess, you know, who knows where this happens. Charlotte in Milwaukee. Charlotte, you're on WTMJ.
Hey, hi, Charlotte. I was just thinking about what you were thinking. If he really loved our country, he would stand down and help someone else run. You know what I mean? Maybe even be secretively helping someone else run. But not showing his face. If he really loved our country.
Yeah, but I mean, you turn on these cable news channels and you see that he's already running these ads trashing Ron DeSantis, who isn't even a candidate right now, but, you know, trashing Ron DeSantis and things like that. I mean, there's no question that he, at least at this point in time, it's attack. And at the same time, though, Charlotte, you know, there's only so many battles that you can fight. You know, and that's what I keep thinking.
Can I say something else?
Sure.
When you're done.
Sure.
Okay. I would like to say, I don't know if that was him that said this, but any news for him is good news because it brings him wealth, I'm sure.
I've always said, Charlotte, you know, there's that old saying that no publicity is bad publicity. And the only people that ever really say that are people who've never had bad publicity. I mean, I'm reading the stories in the Washington Post and the New York Times about the civil trial that's going on. And you have this woman who, you know, says she was sexually assaulted in a dressing room at a New York, you know, department store. And she goes into graphic detail about it. I'm sorry. That's not good publicity. You know, I mean, who in their right mind, you know, I mean, it's just who in their right mind.
But if she wants to be famous,
yeah.
If that's all she wanted.
Yeah, no, but from his perspective, I mean, it's like, oh my gosh, okay, now, you know, now this is coming out. Yeah, it's, and again, I take no position on what happened, but if you're Donald Trump, or I mean, the kids have pretty much backed away from this. You know, they want to get on with their lives, and you kind of wonder how Melania feels about this. The fact that she wasn't at the, you know, announcement when he was going to run again, I think that tells you a lot of stuff. But I'm just saying, as a practical matter, as somebody from my perspective who really does care about this country and who sees some of the directions that the present administration is trying to take us, not going through the legislative process, just saying I'm going to use executive orders to do this and that and the other thing, and I'm going to be a king, and I'm going to say you don't have to pay your student loans, and I'm going to say, people, we're going to pass these rules so that automakers aren't going to be able to manufacture cars that are anything other than the electric vehicles, even though we're not close to being ready for electric vehicles. I was talking to somebody the other night who owns an electric vehicle, and I said, I know, you know, when you hear me rail about this, they said, no. So we love our electric vehicle, but we've got two other regular cars. The electric vehicle is kind of a fun thing to drive around town. We would never not want to have our internal combustion engine vehicles. And but yet that's where Biden's moving us. As somebody who sees the direction this country is going in, you want to, like, scream, wait, we got to do something. But for people who think that Donald Trump is the answer to that, I'm here to tell you it's just not going to happen. Let's talk to Richard in Illinois. Richard, you're on WTMJ.
Hey, how are you? The last couple of calls, kind of, I had to chuckle to myself because they were like, if Trump really loved the country, he'd stand down and be in the background. Well, Trump doesn't love anything except Trump. Who else would have made two rounds of trading cards of himself and whatnot? Yeah. And then because he if he's not in the limelight, he doesn't want to be involved, I'm certain. And then you just mentioned about Biden. I'm not a big Biden fan either, but you mentioned about his executive orders. Do you forget how many executive orders Trump did when he was in office?
Yeah, and Obama before that. That's been the pattern over, especially over like the last, you know, 20 years or so. Just, we don't need Congress. We're just going to do that. No, I agree, and it's that to me, it's a scary thing because we don't have kings in this country. You know, we have a president who runs the executive branch, and you have, you're right, Trump did it, Obama did it as well, and, you know, Biden's doing it big time. You've got all these policies that, you know, you could not get through Congress, so we're just going to bypass Congress. To heck with the process. We're just going to do this, and then we're going to, okay, sue us, see if the courts stop us. And that's a scary thing. And look, and I understand, I always get these texts from people who love Donald Trump. I can't believe you're ripping on Donald Trump. Look, I'm here to tell the truth as I see it. And the truth as I see it is that, and this is, maybe it's just personal, because the idea, I got to tell you, the idea of spending the entire election season next year talking about the choice of being Joe Biden or Donald Trump makes my head want to explode. And you can watch it on our live stream when that happens. It's just not where I want to be. I want different choices. I want people who aren't in their 80s. I want a different vision for this country. And I want a conservative who can win. And that's just not Trump. So very glad to have you with us. By the way, this is the, I think, second full week that we have been doing this. If you want to listen to us, well, it's easy to do that, and lots of people do it. In addition, though, if you want to watch us, we are now streamed live. And matter of fact, we have the lights in the studio turned up so bright. I mean, you could, if I had gone to medical school instead of law school, it's bright enough to do tonsillectomies in here. There's no question about that. But we do that so that the cameras can see us. So if you want to tune in, many ways to do that. We stream the show on YouTube, and you can actually go back and watch it later on the YouTube channel simply by putting in WTMJ and then subscribing. It doesn't cost you any money to subscribe. But the easiest way to do this is probably just to check out, go to WTMJ.com, and you'll see a button that says Listen Live and another button that says Watch Live. And I know a number of you do this because I hear from time to time as people are commenting, oh, that's a nice red sweatshirt you're wearing, or, you know, whatever. So you can do that. It is available as well. And again, I also appreciate everybody who's been downloading and listening to the podcast. And we got some exciting stuff coming up with that, including, I think we'll roll out a new logo for that or sometime very, very soon. Okay. If you are a regular listener, you know that I am an unabashed fan of, I'm an unabashed fan of Summerfest. And Summerfest has faced a number of challenges lately. Attendance has been on the decline in an effort to try to, you know, book, I guess, maybe bigger talent at different parts of the day. Summerfest is cut down. It's no longer 11 days. It's 3 days a week over three weekends. So it's 9 days, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, over three weekends. And that's still an experimental basis. They did it last year. They're doing it this year. I think at some point in time, they're going to take a hard look and say, okay, does this cost us momentum? What makes sense? But Summerfest is, it's a local treasure. There's no question about it. And if Summerfest were to be diminished or, Lord forbid, go away, I think we'd miss it in a big fashion. But Summerfest has challenges just like everybody does, whether it's the brewers or whether it's the ethnic festivals or whether it's, you know, anybody who has events that are trying to get people there. It's different, especially in the COVID-19 world. So Summerfest, you know, rolls out its list of performers, you know, over, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of people who are bands and performers who are going to be performing at the different stages. But let's face it. One of the big driving forces for entertainment at Summerfest to get people to go there is what's going on the main stage. Now, you don't have to go down to Summerfest and go to the main stage, but that's something that drives a lot of the attendance. Oh, there's a show. I've got tickets to see the headliner at the amphitheater at night. I'm going to go down earlier. I'm going to wander around. That's a driving force. And so getting the main stage performers correct is important. So the main stage of the nine, they've got now eight of them that are announced. And one of the reporters for the local newspaper has been obsessed, I think, with the fact that there's a lack of diversity. That's the argument that's being made. The headliners for, okay, up until yesterday or 2 days ago, the headliners, they've announced there's nine main stage shows. There's one still open. And I have a feeling. I think I might know who's going to be there, but I don't know that for sure. So they filled eight. The first seven were, as they're described in the local newspaper, white men or bands led by white men. Eric Church, very, very popular. He's opening night. The Zac Brown Band, which has performed there many times, but it's incredibly popular. James Taylor, all right. The Dave Matthews Band, which remains incredibly popular. Odessa, really don't know Odessa. Zach Bryan, that show, my understanding, is already sold out. He is incredibly popular. And Imagine Dragons, which is very popular. So these performers are either, again, white men like Eric Church, Zach Brown is white, James Taylor is white, Dave Matthews is white, Zach Bryan is white, or bands led by white men. All right. So they announced earlier this week that the eighth show. Well, this is the way the local newspaper writes it. Summerfest in Milwaukee is bringing some much-needed diversity to its American Family Insurance Amphitheater lineup, revealing a July 1st hip-hop show with A Boogie with the Hoodie and Trippy Red with Milwaukee rapper Kia Rap Princess opening. So the Journal Sentinel says, okay, this is great. Now we've got this, you know, we need diversity. So we're going to have, you know, the night where there's the rap show. Now I sent out a tweet about this last night. I have no issue with diversity. Okay. I get it. But diversity for the sake of diversity to me makes no sense. What the obligation Summerfest has is to book the acts, at least in my opinion, particularly on the main stage, that are going to generate the largest number of ticket sales to get the most people in. So I said on my tweet last night, the reporter for the local newspaper is upset over Summerfest booking too many headliners who are white males. Want to bet whether or not Eric Church, Zach Brown, Imagine Dragons, James Taylor, Dave Matthews, Zach Bryan, want to bet whether they sell more tickets than the hip-hop booking? And I have no problem with booking the hip-hop show. That's great. But this idea that, well, we need to have diversity. Well, okay, I appreciate the need for diversity, but at the end of the day, isn't Summerfest a business? And does diversity, particularly when it comes to booking on the main stage, does it trump, no pun intended, does it trump ticket sales? And isn't that the primary obligation? Now, Summerfest over the years has had lots of diversity as far as its main stage performers, whether it's, you know, female artists or whether it's, you know, persons of color that were performing. But it's all a function of who's touring and, you know, who's in the United States and whose schedule it fits in. But this idea that, okay, well, you know, we've got seven shows that are primarily white men or bands that are fronted by white guys, so that means that we have to find more quote-unquote diversity. I'm sorry, I don't buy that. Nothing against diversity. That's fine. But shouldn't what – and look, and I have no idea – I mean, I'm not a surprise to anybody. I'm not a rap music guy, and I have no idea – you know, how popular a Boogie with the Hoodie and some of these other performers, Trippy Red, how I have no idea how that's going to sell. My guess is it's not going to sell as well as Eric Church or Zach Brown or Imagine Dragons or Dave Matthews. Could be wrong, but when it comes to booking the main stage, doesn't Summerfest have an obligation to try to find the performer who is going to, I don't know, put the most butts in the seat? 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. I mean, at what point in time do you say, okay, diversity is fine because you want to bring different audiences in. But if you have, I don't know, if you have an opportunity to book a performer who doesn't meet the diversity standard, but who is going to sell thousands more tickets then another performer who does check off the box, don't you take the most popular performer? 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. Summerfest getting all sorts of static for, okay, it's not as diverse a lineup on the main stage. The main stage, you want to be the biggest performers you can find, regardless of race, regardless of gender, the biggest performers who will sell the most tickets. Pure and simple. 855-616-1620. We discuss. When we do the postmortems on Summerfest, when you look back after the festivals, I mean, what do they look at and how do they judge the success of the festivals? They don't say, oh, we had a really diverse bunch of performers. They say, how many people came through the gates? And, you know, what was the paid attendance and how much money was spent on at vendors places and things like that? It's this kind of objective standard that's out there. And that's why I believe that the mission of Summerfest, particularly when we talk about the main stage, and which I'm referring to, it's of course the American Family Amphitheater, the main stage there. I think that the obligation is, all right, you want to bring in particularly for that venue, as opposed to the side venues. You want to bring in the performers that you can find that are going to sell the most tickets and attract the most people, right? And I think that that's kind of simple. So I'm reading some of the stuff, like the commentary in the local newspaper. American Family Insurance Amphitheater lineup desperately needs diversity. And then, you know, saying, okay, well, you know, of the first seven headliners that were announced, they were all either white men or bands that were headlined by white men. And I'm like looking at the list, and they've got an impressive list of performers that are out there. So now they've added a group of hip hop performers, and that's fine. I have no problem with it, except that this idea of diversity for the sake of diversity. I mean, shouldn't the priority be, let's find a performer if we can that's going to sell out the stadium, that sell out the amphitheater, because that's at the end of the day what we're trying to do. And there's nothing wrong with, if you want to get other performers and you want to put them on the side stages or whatever, that's cool. I'm good with this. But this idea that, okay, we need diversity for the sake of diversity. No, you need to find people that are going to sell the most tickets. 855-616-1620. Let's start with Yvonne in Milwaukee. Yvonne, you're on WTMJ.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As I told your screener, I think I totally agree with you. I feel that Summerfest should be bringing in the acts that people will go and see.
Mm-hmm.
I think they should be the best performers available. I don't care what music it is. It should be the best. And it should not depend on whether you're black, white, or purple. Mm-hmm. It should depend on who you are and
right.
whether or not you're going to draw the crowds.
Right.
I mean, if you're going to put Dion against someone whose name you can't even pronounce, I think you're going to find more people going to see Dion.
Yeah, I guess that's what to me is the ultimate mission of Summerfest, and that's how it's judged. And look, and if you have the opportunity, who did I see? Lionel Richie. I saw Lionel Richie a couple years ago. If you have the opportunity to bring in a performer of color who's going to fill up and they're available and you can get them, and, you know, that's going to a big name that's going to fill up the amphitheater, I'm all in favor of that. That's great. But this idea that, well, you know, because, you know, it's all white men that are out there. Well, in this case, it's white men that I think are pretty much going to sell a lot of tickets. Jeff, here's a text. My husband and I are coming back to Wisconsin to see Eric Church and the Zac Brown Band on separate nights. Zac Brown has played for several years. He's always a sellout or close to. Summerfest is a business, and the main goal is to make money. Well, yeah, the main goal is to get people, you know, through the gates, and you do that by the performers that you put on, and it starts with the main stage. I guess I just think this is kind of a cheap shot, and you want the best performers that are out there. Again, I have no problem. They want to do this hip-hop night. Maybe I'll be proved to be wrong, but my guess is that's not going to sell as many tickets as Zach Brown or Dave Matthews or James Taylor or Eric Church or Zach Bryan or Imagine Dragons, which are all, you know, they're going to sell lots and lots of tickets, which is a good thing. And if you've got a performer, diversity is fine as far as it goes, but diversity for the sake of diversity when it comes to booking a music festival. Tom in Kokana. Tom, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
I think they need diversity within the genre as opposed to the color.
Yeah.
You're going to get the zooplankton to follow those country and western guys all over. How about Dead & Company?
Oh, get them out of Alpine Valley. Have them come up and play Summerfest. The jam band, sure.
Yeah. You know, I think I'm not a country and western guy, as you could tell. I think they need... I saw the Dead back in the day. They got rained out when I saw them, but I ended up at the Stone Toad, and Jerry came in, and he jammed there.
Mm-hmm.
Hell of a night.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I mean, I guess at some point in time, I mean, obviously there's a marketing component to it, and you say diversity of music. It's got to be a genre that's going to attract people. I mean, at the end of the day, how big is the amphitheater? 15,000, 20,000, whatever. I mean, I think the first criteria has to be who are the performers that are out there? What is their availability? And look, and I know there are a lot of performers of color. You know, somebody was saying, well, what about Drake? Well, okay, part of the problem is they have to be on tour and they have to be, you know, in the area on a particular time. I mean, that's apparently there's a lot of people that are touring Europe this year, and it's not a question of, gee, is there a person of color that's out there that's on tour that you can have? But the question is, okay, is this somebody that you can get to play on that available date that's there? But the bottom line of this is, I just think it's unfair and it's a cheap shot to say, well, there's not enough diversity that's there. You want the most popular artists that you can possibly find that are going to sell the most tickets. And so, okay, you've got Hip Hop Night. That's great. I hope it sells out. I really do, because I want to see Summerfest thrive and survive. But if Summerfest fills this last vacant spot with, I don't know, another band that's fronted by a white guy or a white guy, and it's going to sell out, that's what they should be doing. That's what their obligation is.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
I blame it on Wyatt's forecast. I've gone the entire winter without catching a cold or anything like that, and I'm here. We come back from Florida, and it gets cold, then it gets hot, then it gets cold again. And I feel like I've got one of these annoying spring head colds that I always get that is coming on, and listen to this forecast. It's going to be rainy and dreary. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready for the 70 degree weather. This is a story that, to me, at least in my opinion, there's nobody that's right. But I want to get your feelings on this. All right. Everybody knows the background of the Let's Go Brandon chant, right? This goes back to about a year and a half, October of 2021. There's a NASCAR race at the Talladega Speedway in Alabama. Brandon Brown, 28-year-old driver, had just won his first Xfinity Series race, and he's being interviewed on live TV by this NBC reporter. The crowd behind him, while this interview is going out on TV, is chanting blank Joe Biden, except they're not chanting blank. Okay, so that's it. And it's audible. Everybody can hear it. And that's what they're chanting, blank Joe Biden. And the reporter says, well, look at that support. Everybody's chanting, let's go, Brandon. Well, that's not what they were chanting, and everybody knew it except the reporter. Or if the reporter knew it, she decided to make this up. So this quickly became it went viral. And so a lot of people now, it's let's go, Brandon. And there were all sorts of reports, when Biden goes out, you get this chant. And it's a way of saying, well, you know, blank Joe Biden, without saying blank Joe Biden. But that's what Let's Go Brandon has come to mean. All right, so there it is. So this story comes from Michigan. It's at elementary school. February of 2022, a mother's sixth grade son wore a Let's Go Brandon sweatshirt to Tri-County Middle School. The assistant principal at the school stopped him in the hallway and told him to take it off, told him that the slogan was the equivalent to, quote, the F word. And then the kid ended up taking it off because he didn't want to get sent home or, you know, disciplined another way. The suit says, this is a lawsuit, the student wore the sweatshirt again in early 2022 and was asked by a teacher to take it off, adding, I've told you before and I won't tell you again. In May, this would be May of last year, the student's older brother, an eighth grader at the same school, was removed from class and asked to remove his Let's Go Brandon sweatshirt, according to this lawsuit. The school says that this is our rule. The district prohibits clothing or styles of expression that are vulgar or profane. All right, so you can't, That's what it says. You can't have clothing or styles of expression that are vulgar or profane. They say Let's Go Brandon is a transparent code for using profanity against the president. So, you know, they're arguing that the dress code prevents clothing that are obscene or contains messages or illustrations that are lewd, indecent, vulgar, or profane. All right. So what happens is the parents, the mom and the dad, have now sued the school. And they're saying, look, you're interfering with the kids' rights. You have the right to have a dress code. But the dress code says you're not allowed to show up in clothing that is vulgar or profane. This says, Let's Go Brandon. And whatever other meanings Let's Go Brandon might have, it's not in and of itself vulgar or profane. If the kid showed up in a sweatshirt that said blank Joe Biden, that would be one thing. But there's no basis to tell him he can't wear a sweatshirt that says Let's Go Brandon. All right, our number is 855-616-1620. That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. I have a very strong opinion on this, but I'm curious as to what you think. Okay, who's right and who's wrong? School says, look, we know what Let's Go Brandon means, and that is just another way of saying something that would be vulgar or profane, even though it's not in and of itself vulgar and profane. We don't think the kid should be able to wear it. The parents are saying, look, there's nothing about Let's Go Brandon which in and of itself is vulgar or profane, and it doesn't apply. The rules should not stop him from being able to wear the shirt. And for whatever, for what it's worth, my understanding is the dress code doesn't prohibit people wearing T-shirts or sweatshirts or whatever that express political opinions on it. It's just it can't be vulgar or profane. And the parents are saying, we don't think that there's nothing vulgar or profane per se about Let's Go Brandon, and the kid should be allowed to wear it. 855-616-1620, that's the Old National Bank talk and text line. Who, if anyone, is right? That's the Old National Bank talk and text line. All right, the story is, if you're just tuning in, sixth grade kid comes to his grade school wearing a T-shirt that says, Let's Go Brandon. We all know the history of that. The school says, nope, we've got a policy that says that you cannot wear clothing that is lewd or obscene. And even though this, in and of itself, Let's Go Brandon, is not lewd or obscene, we know that this is a metaphor for, you know, something that is lewd and obscene, so you have to take it off. The mom has now filed a lawsuit against the school district. Who's right? Who's wrong? Let's start with Janelle in Germantown. Janelle, you're on WTMJ.
Hi, Jeff. I'm so glad you started with me because I feel very strongly about this. Keeping aside my personal opinions on the Let's Go Brandon, which I find incredibly immature and unnuanced, it's black and white. It obviously means what it means. It's not appropriate. This mom is insane for thinking her child's rights or whatever were trumped upon, so to speak. Like, there's no nuance there. It's wrong. I think it's so obvious.
Okay, so the fact that even though the statement in and of itself is not on its face obscene or lewd or anything, your point would be we all know what this means, so he shouldn't be able to wear it to school.
Right. It is so crystal clear that those three words are not meant to be taken at face value. I would counter with, like, another example. If a child came to school wearing a shirt that said,
be careful now, be careful,
a chicken, to a picture of a chicken,
okay,
picture of a chicken.
Okay.
Would that be lewd? Very obvious.
Got it.
You know, it's like, we know what it means. We're adults.
Right. No, okay. Good enough. Thanks for calling, Janelle. I appreciate it. I want to get a kind of a sense from the audience as to whether the school has gone too far. And again, if it the rule says it has to be lewd or vulgar or obscene. That's what the rule is, as opposed to a broader thing that says, okay, we want to ban political statements. And you could make the argument that it's clearly a political statement. All right, let's talk to Mike in Illinois. Mike, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jeff. You kind of stole my thunder because that's what I think it is. I completely disagree with the previous caller. People can know what it means. But if you start down that road, there'd be all sorts of little things that people could say, and they say, oh, you know what, that's vulgar and obscene. I'm taking that this way. You can't, you have to do it at what it says on the shirt, not what you are interpreting it to mean, what it says exactly. And it says, let's go Brandon. Yes, most people know what that means, but that in itself is not vulgar. If the school said no political statements, because that's what I think that is more than anything,
right,
I would say absolutely. But I believe the parents are right.
Okay, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Now, that's two diametrically opposed positions. Here's one of our texts that makes the point that Mike was just making. If the rules were no political messages, I would side with the schools. But I have to side with the parents. I don't think this is vulgar, although I certainly don't or wouldn't make such a big deal about it that I would sue. Here's another one. Jeff, my husband is a public high school teacher, and he on occasion has students change T-shirts if there's blatant misogyny on them. Also, no gun images. Well, it's sort of a different sort of thing. And again, I think the school has a right to make its dress code what its dress code is. And if you wanted to have the dress code that says no gun images, I think that that's fine. No political statements. That's fine. They have a right to do it. Now, this particular school, that's not what the rule says. So, well, let me take another call here before I tell you where I come down on this. Tim in Appleton. Tim, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I taught school for 30 years, and I was a reading specialist, so I got a lot of the naughty boys in there and had to learn how to control them. Well, one time a school board member came in and said, you got to change my daughter's grade from a B+ to an A. I said, I can't do that. The principal has to do that. Well, the principal did it. Pretty soon, the parents were coming in and telling me I had to change a grade. So the schools have been going downhill from who's in charge. Today, kids are in charge, and the parents will hire an attorney to back up the kid. And that's what's going on here.
You know, Tim, it's interesting because my take is a slight variation of what you're saying. I think the school, I'm not sure they're on a firm legal ground because I even though we all know what this means, it's not on its face. It's not obscene or vulgar in and of itself. But you know what I was thinking when I was talking about this story? There's no way in God's green earth that my mom would have let me out of the house wearing that T-shirt or that sweatshirt. It's just my mother would have said, "Why do you have that sweatshirt on? Now take it off. It's inappropriate for school." Much less decided to sue if I got to school and the school told me I was supposed to take it off. That to me is the biggest takeaway. My mom wouldn't have let me out of the house wearing that.
Of course, but in this case, you've got a kid who's going to dictate to the school what they can wear.
Yeah, no, thank. Or in this case, it's the parents. And I guess I just my take on this is like everybody's wrong. I think the school's dress code as written is too narrow to cover this. And I think maybe that's the starting point that the school, you know, needs to go back and think about expanding. And if the school decides to do that, I'm 100% behind. A number of people are saying this is why you have school uniforms. Well, yeah, because it is a question of, you know, where when you start saying, okay, what is a political statement or what isn't? But I mean, I think it would be fair to say that that's what this is. It's a tougher thing to say that this is vulgar or obscene because it's not on its face. And people are on the text line, we're kind of exploding with people giving, you know, different examples about what if it was this or what if it was that. And I'm uncomfortable reading a lot of them on the radio. But I get the idea. You have to look at it on a case by case basis. So I think if the school is concerned with this type of stuff, they probably need to broaden their dress code because, honestly, even though we know what the phrase "Let's go Brandon" means, I don't think showing up with that on as a T-shirt necessarily fits within the parameters of what their dress code is. But having said all that, it's still, as I often say on this program, just because you have a right to do something doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. And I am sitting there thinking, why would the mom send the kid to – it's a sixth grader – why would you send the kid to school wearing a Let's Go Brandon T-shirt? I mean, I understand how, I don't care how you feel about, you know, Joe Biden or whatever, and I don't care if you want to go to rallies and chant Let's Go Brandon or whatever. I mean, that I take no position on. It's just, I mean, who, I could never get out of the house wearing something like that. And if I wore something like that and I went to school and the assistant principal said, Jeff, you've got to take that off. The biggest conversation would be when I got home and I got in trouble. I wore the sweatshirt and they told me I had to take it off. The biggest conversation with Ann and Jack Wagner would be, why did you think it was a good idea to wear that shirt in the first place when we all know what it means? This is just one of those occasions where I don't think anybody is right. School has a right to have a dress code. I don't think that their interpretation of the dress code for this particular thing, I think it's too broad. I do. But that doesn't mean it was the right thing to wear the sweatshirt to school. A pox on all their houses. So very glad to have you with us. You know, this guy, this Massachusetts Air National Guardsman, Jack Texeira, who is responsible for these massive leaks of intelligence. He's back in the news, and it's raising more and more questions. So he's been charged by federal officials, and my guess is he's going to get indicted, and there's going to be all sorts of extra charges as well. But they're starting to look into this guy's background. Turns out he was suspended from high school in 2018 for making comments about the use of Molotov cocktails and other weapons. He was trolling the internet looking for information about mass shootings. He engaged in regular discussions about violence and murder on the same social platform that he used to post classified information. He surrounded his bed at his parents' house with firearms and tactical gear. I mean, in other words, there's all these red flags that are up there. And yet, this guy was able to access some of the nation's most closely, you would think, guarded secrets, and not only access them, but he was able to print them out, and he was able to photocopy them, and then he was able to put them up on the internet for months without anybody knowing. Now, I mean, he's going to take a real hard fall for this, but the bottom line is that this, I think, it really underscores a huge problem that we have. There's no way that a 21-year-old guy from the Massachusetts Air National Guard should be able to have access, certainly not to the point of being able to print and duplicate and then post this sort of information. It's just mind-boggling to me that there's no security protocols that even if, okay, he's an IT guy, so that means he needs to have access to systems. Well, somebody should be monitoring and saying, okay, you know, we noticed that you access these things. Why was it that you thought it was necessary to access, I don't know, confidential information regarding diplomats dealing with China or whatever? I mean, somebody should have seen the types of things he was looking at and said, what does this have to do with what your job is to make sure that the internet doesn't crash or whatever? And at the very least, there should be somebody saying, okay, and even if your job might require you to be able to get into certain computer systems, why did you need to print out these documents? And how was it that nobody noticed that you not only printed out the documents, but you were able to leave secure facilities with them? It's just, that's the stunning failure in this idea that, well, you know, we've got computer systems and we need people to be able to access stuff, you know, to keep the computer systems running. It's one thing to say you're an IT guy and you need to, I don't know, be able to figure out if there's a problem, how to fix something. It's another thing to say just because you're an IT guy, we're going to give you, and it sounds like you're kind of crazy to begin with, we're going to give you classified security access, and then we're not going to monitor what you do with that. That's where the red flag should be going off, period. I mean, it's like, well, I'm not an IT guy, but it would be like if somehow I got access to our internal billing things and things like that, or everybody access to, you know, everybody's, you know, personnel records or whatever. You would think that somebody would say, Jeff, why was it that you were, I don't know, looking at Wyatt Barmore Pooley's personnel file or something like that? And I'd go, oh, humana, that really doesn't impact your job. Who knows what we would find, Wyatt, in your personnel file, huh?
It's like I've had several background checks run on me in the last several years, what with moving and getting new jobs. I'm really not that interesting.
No, it's not. My life, it's the same sort of thing. My life is pretty much an open book. I mean, there's not too many secrets that are out there that aren't shared.
Yeah, I got to watch out for Master Hacker Jeff Wagner, though.
Yeah, hard. Well, but that would be the point. I have no business being there, and you would think that somebody somewhere would say, okay, Jeff, if even somehow this was a portion of your job, What was it? If your job is to keep up the internet system, why were you in Wyatt's personnel file? Somebody would know that, and that's your personnel file, which, just like mine, is probably not too interesting. But if you're talking about a treasure trove of national secrets, that should be. Gosh, why did this airman, Massachusetts National Guard airman, what was he doing? What was he doing? You know, checking out these type of documents. Just asking. Once again, if you like the program, you can download the podcast. We're on Spotify. We're on Apple Podcasts. You can do it through our website, WTMJ.com. And I know a lot of you do. And I particularly know when we don't get it posted that, you know, there's people out there, why wasn't this posted from Thursday or Friday? And then I always look at my long-suffering producer, Charlie, and say, Charlie, let's figure this out, because there are people who care about this. And I appreciate that very much. And as we've been talking about for the last week or two now, I now work in this environment where, again, the lights are turned up so bright that you could, if I knew how to take out people's tonsils, I could take out people's tonsils, because we are now live streaming. We've got cameras all over, and if you want to watch it, there's many ways to do it. YouTube, there's a YouTube channel. All you do is put in WTMJ, and it'll come up, and you'll be able to watch past examples. But some people actually watch it live, and I know that because we get the numbers, but also you get comments about, oh, you're wearing a red sweatshirt today. Yes. Yes, I am. So you can do that in many fashions, a YouTube channel. But the easiest way is just WTMJ.com, and there's a listen live button, and there's a watch live button, and you can hit it. No, those are not the buttons that I dislike. Here's the button that I dislike. Let me back into this. So I was at the baseball game Tuesday night. I think if you're a regular listener, you know that I'm a big fan of the Brewers. I have a 20-pack of season tickets, a partial season ticket holder. It's 20 packs. And we were I was there Tuesday night with my buddy Evan, who we go to most of the games together. And I actually – I was able to get some extra tickets through WTMJ, so my wife – Fran and a number of our friends, and we had about 6 or 8 or 10 people or whatever that went to the game. Couldn't all sit together, but we were there at the game, so I had a good time. Brewers lost, but they can't win them all. So when you're at the Miller Park, American Family Field is now, it's cashless, right? So you can't buy a beer in the stands and give the vendor like a $20 and say, give me $5 back, you keep the rest. You can't do that anymore. So every transaction has to be via a credit card. And at American Family Field and at other places as well, what you do is you put your card in the reader, and then what happens is it shows you the amount. And the first thing it asks you is, before it shows you the total, first thing it asks you is, would you like to leave a tip? And there's the button, 10%, 15%, 20%, 25%, whatever they might be, no tip or other. And there is, they call this guilt tipping, because the implied thing is, hey, you put your credit card in there, and there's kind of an expectation that you are going to leave a tip, and it's going to be a percentage of what the cost is, as opposed to, hey, the beers were, you know, $12, give me $5, you keep the extra $3. Now it's got to be a percentage. So you're doing the math on this. It's also, it pops up all the time at American Family Field, for example. They have self-service kiosks where, yes, there's some where you go to the vendors, but there's a number of kiosks where you kind of walk in, and they've got a cooler, and they've got all sorts of beers, and they've got all sorts of soda, and they got peanuts and, you know, whatever. And you help yourself. You take out, a can of Miller Lite, and then you take out a thing of peanuts, and then you go up to the scanner. And just like at a grocery store, you scan it. You scan the beer. You scan the peanut thing. And there is typically a person that's there. There might be 5 or 6 checkout things. But there's a person there to help out people, because inevitably people have problems with this, trying to figure out how to do it. But it's not like anybody's serving you. They're not pouring your beer. They're not getting your hot dogs. It's just they're there. And that's the first question that'll be asked. So you've gone to the self-service thing. You've taken the can of Miller Lite. You've taken the peanuts. You've scanned them. It comes out to $16 or whatever. And the first thing you're going to be asked is, do you want to leave a tip? And my question is always, for what? You know, I mean, why would I leave a tip? I mean, I should be tipping myself. Nobody did anything, you know, for me. In addition, when you go to the different checkout counters, you know, you stand in line and you say, okay, I want two brats and whatever. The first question it asks is, do you want to leave a tip? Now, I think especially when there's like charity groups that are there and their money, you know, goes to support them, I'm inclined to do that. At the same time, I mean, historically, would it occur to me to leave 15 or 20% on a tip on just to the guy that just went and grabbed the two hot dogs and gave them to me? And historically, I probably wouldn't. I might round up. I might throw a little bit in the tip jar. But 10 or 20%, I don't know. So, but there's almost like there's this expectation. There's a story I'm looking at in the New York Times today talking about how as things have gone this way, they call it guilt tipping. And there's an expectation that where we normally would not tip, or certainly we wouldn't tip 15 or 20%, now there's kind of this expectation that we're going to do it. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. As people who, as servers, for example, at places that I regularly patronize, I think would pretty much testify, I think I am a relatively generous tipper. I mean, I generally, especially, you know, if the service is good, I've always figured that I'm at a point in my life where, you know, an extra couple bucks to me means less than it would to the person that's getting it. So I try to do that, and that's my basic philosophy. But at the same time, on for things where I'm getting my own beer, I'm getting my own peanuts, I'm not going to leave a tip. And I appreciate that there's somebody that's standing there that would help me if I can't figure out how to ring these things up. But that's, to me, that's not tip worthy. I wrestle with just going to a counter and ordering something, whether, you know, that's, if you go into McDonald's and you order something and you pay for that, you know, with a credit card, I mean, do you leave a 15 or 20% tip? And if not, why not? 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. I confess, I'm beginning to hate the button. If nothing else, just because of this implicit sort of societal or peer pressure that you should be leaving tips, especially in cases where you otherwise wouldn't. 855-616-1620. We discuss. 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. I mean, I raise this question. If you go into Culver's, you go through the drive-thru at Culver's, all right? And so you order, I want a butter burger and I want a vanilla shake. And then you pull up to the window and the person behind the window gives you the butter burger and the vanilla shake. Is there an expectation that you would add 10 or 15 or 20%? I mean, do you tip for that? If you go into McDonald's and you order a Big Mac extra value meal and they give you the Big Mac extra value meal, is there an expectation that you should tip 15 to 20% on that? And again, I don't mean to pick on American Family Field, but at the same time, I mean, it's almost like nobody's holding a gun to your head and saying that you have to do it and you want to do the right thing, but is there a limit? What's tippable or not? And one of the things that's happened since COVID, especially since we've done away with cash and now it's all credit cards, is there is this implied that it's what they call social guilt tipping. So where do you draw the line? Let's start with Mike in Mequon. Mike, you're on WTMJ.
Good afternoon, Jeff. I think you're following me around for show ideas. Literally 15 minutes ago, I went to an unnamed cookie store in Grafton, and I thought I'd save some time by getting them online and taking them back to my coworkers. And as I got to the end, they had tacked on an automatic $3 tip, and then it gave you options of 5, 10, 15, and 20%, and no option not to give them the $3.
Really?
I'm not making this up. I'm not. This just happened.
So, I mean, so it's actually, it's not like a tip. It's almost like a surcharge for the employees that they're calling a tip.
Yeah, I'm ordering online, which I think would make it more efficient for them, and they're penalizing me for it. And I have no problem. I have no problem. If somebody asks or, you know, requires a tip, they're not getting a dime from me. I don't have any social guilt.
thanks for calling. Well, it is interesting as to what and that's the thing. Just because somebody does something that's part of their regular job, does that make it tippable? Now, historically, there have been some workers who it's been understood, like in the hospitality industry, it's been understood that they're going to depend on tips. They make less than minimum wage, and so it's understood that they're going to get, you know, X percentage of tips, and that's been there. This is, of course, expanding now. 855-616-1620, and there's nothing that says you can't do it. Heather in West Dallas. Hi, Heather. You're on WTMJ.
Hi, Jeff.
What do you think?
I just want to say I work at AmFam Field. I work in a marketplace just like you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plenty of people, more than half, that do not tip. And they a lot of times say, well, who am I tipping myself? Who stocks those coolers for an hour or two at the end of the game? Who cleans up their mess? Who IDs them? Who gives them some conversation that makes them feel glad that they're there? It isn't a have to, but if they want to, or they get good service, or they're comfortable and can joke around with you, there's nothing wrong with it.
Well, there's nothing wrong with it, but and Heather, that's fine. People want to give the money, but at the same time, that's like saying I'm going to tip at the grocery store because you've got the stockers that come out, and you know every night after the store closes, you've got the stockers that come out and they stock the shelves. That's their job. I mean, should we be tipping the kids in the grocery store?
Well, no, but that is I work all during the game.
Mm-hmm.
Putting up with all the people that have had too much to drink, putting up all the people that say, oh, my gosh, the cost of this.
Yeah.
And then I for a couple hours and restock. So. Yeah,
no, thanks, Heather. Look, and I don't begrudge people doing that. I'm wondering where we draw the line. I mean, because, again, it sounds like do we tip checkers at the grocery store? Do we tip the people that are stocking the grocery store shelves? I mean, do we, you know, when you go into the grocery store, for example, and you go to that self-service line, and there's always the person that's there helping, making sure that people know how to work the things, do you tip them? And again, it's up to any individual as to what they want to do and what they don't want to do. I'm just saying that candidly, I think at some point in time, there's lines that get to be drawn. And if people, you know, if people want to get all themselves, the stuff themselves and leave a tip for, you know, the person that later on is going to stock it, go with God. That's fine. But I think that somehow the tipping, we need to have better rules, I guess, as to who gets tipped and how much.